A man explained it. The knot, what I've called the pincushion, is formed by wrapping the hair around a piece of fabric. In back, where the knot is split, the fabric is left visible. It might be any design or color, but in the case of an apprentice geisha, after a certain point in her life at least, it's always red silk. One night, a man said to me, "Most of these innocent little girls have no idea how provocative the split peach hairstyle really is. Imagine that you're walking along behind a young geisha, thinking all sorts of naughty thoughts about what you might like to do to her, and then you see on her head this split peach shape with a big splash of red inside the cleft. And what do you think of?" Well, I didn't think of anything at all, and I told him so. "You aren't using your imagination," he said. After a moment, I understood, and turned so red he laughed to see it. On my way back to the Okya, it didn't matter to me that my poor scalp felt the way clay must feel after the potter has scored it with a sharp stick. Every time I caught a glimpse of myself in the glass of a shop, I felt I was someone to be taken seriously, not a girl anymore, but a young woman. When I reached the Okya, Auntie made me model my hair for her and said all sorts of kind things. Even Pumpkin couldn't resist walking once around me admiringly, though Hatsumoma would have been angry if she'd known. And what do you suppose Mother's reaction was? She stood on her tiptoes to see better, which did her little good because already I was taller than she was, and then complained that I probably ought to have gone to Hatsumomo's hairdresser rather than Mameha's. Every young geisha may be proud of her hairstyle at first, but she comes to hate it within 3 or 4 days. Because, you see, if a girl comes home exhausted from the hairdresser and lays her head down on a pillow for a nap, just as she did the night before, her hair will be flattened out of shape. The moment she awakens, she'll have to go right back to the hairdresser again. For this reason, a young apprentice geisha must learn a new way of sleeping after her hair is styled for the first time. She doesn't use an ordinary pillow any longer, but a takamakura, which I've mentioned before. It's not so much a pillow as a cradle for the base of the neck. Most are padded with a bag of wheat chaff, but still they're not much better than putting your neck on a stone. You lie there on your futon with your hair suspended in the air, thinking everything is fine until you fall asleep. But when you wake up, you've shifted somehow so that your head has settled back on the mats, and your hairstyle is as flat as if you hadn't bothered to use a tall pillow in the first place. In my case, Auntie helped me to avoid this by putting a tray of rice flour on the mats beneath my hair. Whenever my head drooped back while I slept, my hair sank into the rice flour, which stuck to the wax and ruined my hairstyle. I'd already watched Pumpkin go through this ordeal. Now it was my turn. For a time, I woke up every morning with my hair ruined and had to wait in line at the hairdresser for my chance to be tortured. Every afternoon during the week leading up to my debut, Auntie dressed me in the complete regalia of an apprentice geisha and made me walk up and down the dirt corridor of the Okya to build up my strength. In the beginning, I could scarcely walk at all and worried I might tip over backward. Young girls dress much more ornately than older women, you see, which means brighter colors and showier fabrics, but also a longer obi. A mature woman will wear the obi tied in back in a manner we call the drum knot, because it makes a tidy little box shape. This doesn't require very much fabric. But a girl younger than around 20 or so wears her obi in a showier fashion. In the case of an apprentice geisha, this means the most dramatic fashion of all, a derari obi, dangling obi, knotted almost as high as the shoulder blades and with the ends hanging nearly to the ground. No matter how brightly colored a kimono might be, the obi is nearly always brighter. When an apprentice geisha walks down the street in front of you, you notice not her kimono, but rather her brightly colored dangling obi, with just a margin of kimono showing at the shoulders and on the sides. To achieve this effect, the obi must be so long that it stretches all the way from one end of the room to the other. But it isn't the length of the obi that makes it hard to wear. It's the weight, for it's nearly always made of heavy silk brocade. Just to carry it up the stairs is exhausting, so you can imagine how it feels to wear it, the thick band of it squeezing your middle like one of those awful snakes, and the heavy fabric hanging behind, making you feel as if someone has strapped a traveling trunk to your back. To make matters worse, the kimono itself is also heavy, with long, swinging sleeves. I don't mean sleeves that drape over the hand onto the ground. You may have noticed that when a woman is wearing kimono and stretches out her arms, the fabric below the sleeve hangs down to form something like a pocket. This baggy pocket, which we call the furi, is the part that's so long on the kimono of an apprentice geisha. It can easily drag along the ground if a girl isn't careful, and when she dances, she will certainly trip over her sleeves if she doesn't wrap them many times around the forearm to keep them out of the way. Years later, a famous scientist from Kyoto University, when he was very drunk one night, said something about the costume of an apprentice geisha that I've never forgotten. "The mandrill of Central Africa is often considered the showiest of primates," he said, "but I believe the apprentice geisha of Gion is perhaps the most brilliantly colored primate of all." Finally, the day came when Mameha and I were to perform the ceremony binding us as sisters. I bathed early and spent the rest of the morning dressing. Auntie helped me with the finishing touches on my makeup and hair. Because of the wax and makeup covering my skin, I had the strange sensation of having lost all feeling in my face. Every time I touched my cheek, I could feel only a vague sense of pressure from my finger. I did it so many times, Auntie had to redo my makeup. Afterward, as I studied myself in the mirror, a most peculiar thing happened. I knew that the person kneeling before the makeup stand was me, but so was the unfamiliar girl gazing back. I actually reached out to touch her. She wore the magnificent makeup of a geisha. Her lips were flowering red on a stark white face, and her cheeks tinted a soft pink. Her hair was ornamented with silk flowers and sprigs of unhusked rice. She wore a formal kimono of black with the crest of the Nida Okia. When at last I could bring myself to stand, I went into the hall and looked in astonishment at myself in the full-length mirror. Beginning at the hem of my gown, an embroidered dragon circled up the bottom of the robe to the middle of my thigh. His mane was woven in threads lacquered with a beautiful reddish tint. His claws and teeth were silver, his eyes gold, real gold. I couldn't stop tears from welling up in my eyes and had to look straight up at the ceiling to keep them from rolling onto my cheeks. Before leaving the Okia, I took the handkerchief the chairman had given me and tucked it into my obi for good luck. Auntie accompanied me to Mameha's apartment, where I expressed my gratitude to Mameha and pledged to honor and respect her. Then the three of us walked to the Gion shrine, where Mameha and I clapped our hands and announced to the gods that we would soon be bound as sisters. I prayed for their favor in the years ahead, and then closed my eyes and thanked them for having granted me the wish I'd pleaded for 3.5 years earlier, that I should become a geisha. The ceremony was to take place at the Ichiriki Tea House, which is certainly the best-known tea house in all of Japan. It has quite a history, partly because of a famous samurai who hid himself there in the early 1700s. If you've ever heard the story of the 47 Ronin who avenged their master's death and afterward killed themselves by seppuku, well, it was their leader who hid himself in the Ichiriki Tea House while plotting revenge. Most of the first-class tea houses in Gion are invisible from the street, except for their simple entrances, but the Ichiriki is as obvious as an apple on a tree. It sits at a prominent corner of Shijo Avenue, surrounded by a smooth apricot-colored wall with its own tiled roof. It seemed like a palace to me. We were joined there by two of Mameha's younger sisters, as well as by Mother. When we all had assembled in the exterior garden, a maid led us through the entrance hall and down a beautiful meandering corridor to a small tatami room in the back. I'd never been in such elegant surroundings before. Every piece of wood trim gleamed. Every plaster wall was perfect in its smoothness. I smelled the sweet, dusty fragrance of kuroyaki, charblack, a sort of perfume made by charring wood and grinding it into a soft gray dust. It's very old-fashioned, and even Mameha, who was as traditional a geisha as you would find, preferred something more Western, but all the kuroyaki worn by generations of geisha still haunted the ichiriki. I have some even now, which I keep in a wooden vial, and when I smell it, I see myself back there once again. The ceremony, which was attended by the mistress of the ichiriki, lasted only about 10 minutes. A maid brought a tray with several sake cups, and Mameha and I drank together. I took 3 sips from a cup, and then passed it to her, and she took 3 sips. We did this with 3 different cups, and then it was over. From that moment on, I was no longer known as Chiyo. I was the novice geisha Sayuri. During the first months of apprenticeship, a young geisha is known as a novice and cannot perform dances or entertain on her own without her older sister, and in fact does little besides watching and learning. As for my name of Sayuri, Mameha had worked with her fortune-teller a long while to choose it. The sound of a name isn't all that matters, you see. The meaning of the characters is very important as well, and so is the number of strokes used to write them. For there are lucky and unlucky stroke counts. My new name came from Sa, meaning together, Yu, from the zodiac sign for the hen, in order to balance other elements in my personality, and Ri, meaning understanding. All the combinations involving an element from Mameha's name, unfortunately, had been pronounced inauspicious by the fortune-teller. I thought Sayuri was a lovely name, but it felt strange not to be known as Chiyo any longer. After the ceremony, we went into another room for a lunch of red rice, made of rice mixed with red beans. I picked at it, feeling strangely unsettled, and not at all like celebrating. The mistress of the tea-house asked me a question, and when I heard her call me Sayuri, I realized what was bothering me. It was as if the little girl named Chiyo, running barefoot from the pond to her tipsy house, no longer existed. I felt that this new girl, Sayuri, with her gleaming white face and her red lips, had destroyed her. Mameha planned to spend the early afternoon taking me around Gion to introduce me to the mistresses of the various tea houses and okia with which she had relationships. But we didn't head out the moment lunch was done. Instead, she took me into a room at the ichiriki and asked me to sit. Of course, a geisha never really sits while wearing kimono. What we call sitting is probably what other people would call kneeling. In any case, after I'd done it, she made a face at me and told me to do it again. The robes were so awkward it took me several tries to manage it properly. Mameha gave me a little ornament in the shape of a gourd and showed me how to wear it dangling on my obi. The gourd, being hollow and light, is thought to offset the heaviness of the body, you see, and many a clumsy young apprentice has relied upon one to help keep her from falling down. Mameha talked with me a while, and then, just as we were ready to leave, asked me to pour her a cup of tea. The pot was empty, but she told me to pretend to pour it anyway. She wanted to see how I held my sleeve out of the way when I did it. I thought I knew exactly what she was looking for and tried my best, but Mameha was unhappy with me. "First of all," she said, "whose cup are you filling?" "Yours," I said. "Well, for heaven's sake, you don't need to impress me. Pretend I'm someone else. Am I a man or a woman?" "A man," I said. "All right, then. Pour me a cup again." I did so, and Mameha practically broke her neck trying to peer up my sleeve as I held my arm out. "How do you like that?" she asked me, "because that's exactly what's going to happen if you hold your arm so high." I tried pouring again with my arm a bit lower. This time she pretended to yawn, and then turned and began a conversation with an imaginary geisha sitting on the other side of her. "I think you're trying to tell me that I bored you," I said. "But how can I bore you just pouring a cup of tea?" "You may not want me looking up your sleeve, but that doesn't mean you have to act prissy. A man is interested in only one thing. Believe me, you'll understand all too soon what I'm talking about. In the meantime, you can keep him happy by letting him think he's permitted to see parts of your body no one else can see. If an apprentice geisha acts the way you did just then, pouring tea just like a maid would, The poor man will lose all hope. Try it again, but first, show me your arm. So I drew my sleeve up above the elbow and held my arm out for her to see. She took it and turned it in her hands to look at the top and bottom. You have a lovely arm and beautiful skin. You should make sure every man who sits near you sees it at least once. So I went on, pouring tea again and again, until Mameha felt satisfied that I drew my sleeve out of the way enough to show my arm without being too obvious what I was doing. I looked laughable if I hiked my sleeve up to my elbow. The trick was to act like I was merely pulling it out of the way, while at the same time drawing it a few finger widths above my wrist to give a view of my forearm. Mameha said the prettiest part of the arm was the underside, so I must always be sure to hold the teapot in such a way that the man saw the bottom of my arm rather than the top. She asked me to do it again, this time pretending I was pouring tea for the mistress of the Ichiriki. I showed my arm in just the same way, and Mameha made a face at once. "For heaven's sake, I am a woman," she said. "Why are you showing me your arm that way? Probably you're just trying to make me angry." "Angry? What else am I supposed to think? You're showing me how youthful and beautiful you are, while I'm already old and decrepit. Unless you were doing it just to be vulgar." "How is it vulgar? Why else have you made such a point of letting me see the underside of your arm? You may as well show me the bottom of your foot, or the inside of your thigh. If I happen to catch a glimpse of something here or there, well, that's all right, but to make such a point of showing it to me." So I poured a few more times until I'd learned a more demure and suitable method, whereupon Mameha announced that we were ready to go out into Gion together. Already by this time, I'd been wearing the complete ensemble of apprentice geisha for several hours. Now I had to try walking all around Gion in the shoes we call okobo. They're quite tall and made of wood, with lovely lacquered thongs to hold the foot in place. Most people think it very elegant the way they taper down like a wedge, so that the footprint at the bottom is about half the size of the top. But I found it hard to walk delicately in them. I felt as if I had roof tiles strapped to the bottoms of my feet. Mameha and I made perhaps 20 stops at various okia and tea houses, though we spent no more than a few minutes at most of them. Usually a maid answered the door, and Mameha asked politely to speak with the mistress. Then, when the mistress came, Mameha said to her, "I'd like to introduce my new younger sister, Sayuri." And then I bowed very low and said, "I beg your favor, please, mistress." The mistress and Mameha would chat for a moment, and then we left. At a few of the places we were asked in for tea and spent perhaps 5 minutes. But I was very reluctant to drink tea and only wet my lips instead. Using the toilet while wearing kimono is one of the most difficult things to learn, and I wasn't at all sure I'd learned it adequately just yet. In any case, within an hour, I was so exhausted it was all I could do to keep from groaning as I walked along. But we kept up our pace. In those days, I suppose there were probably 30 or 40 first-class tea houses in Gion, and another 100 or so of a somewhat lower grade. Of course, we couldn't visit them all. We went to the 15 or 16 where Mameha was accustomed to entertaining. As for okia, there must have been hundreds of those, but we went only to the few with which Mameha had some sort of relationship. Soon after 3 o'clock, we were finished. I would have liked nothing better than to go back to the okia and fall asleep for a long while, but Mameha had plans for me that very evening. I was to attend my first engagement as a novice geisha. "Go take a bath," she said to me. "You've been perspiring a good deal, and your makeup hasn't held up." It was a warm fall day, you see, and I'd been working very hard. Back at the okia, Auntie helped me undress and then took pity on me by letting me nap for a half hour. I was back in her good graces then, now that my foolish mistakes were behind me and my future seemed even brighter than pumpkins. She woke me after my nap, and I rushed to the bathhouse as quickly as I could. By 5, I had finished dressing and applying my makeup. I was terribly excited, as you can imagine, because for years I'd watched Hatsumomo and lately Pumpkin go off in the afternoons and evenings looking beautiful and now at last my turn had come. The event that evening, the first I would ever attend, was to be a banquet at the Kansai International Hotel. Banquets are stiffly formal affairs, with all the guests arranged shoulder to shoulder in a sort of U-shape around the outside of a big tatami room, and trays of food sitting on little stands in front of them. The geisha, who are there to entertain, move around the center of the room, inside the U-shape made by all the trays, I mean, and spend only a few minutes kneeling before each guest to pour sake and chat. It wasn't what you'd call an exciting affair, and as a novice, my role was less exciting even than Mameha's. I stayed to one side of her like a shadow. Whenever she introduced herself, I did the same, bowing very low and saying, "My name is Sayuri. I am a novice and beg your indulgence." After that, I said nothing more, and no one said anything to me. Toward the end of the banquet, the doors at one side of the room were slid open, and Mameha and another geisha performed a dance together known as Chio no Tomo, Friends Everlasting. It's a lovely piece about two devoted women meeting again after a long absence. Most of the men sat picking their teeth through it. They were executives of a large company that made rubber valves, or some such thing, and had gathered in Kyoto for their annual banquet. I don't think a single one of them would have known the difference between dancing and sleepwalking, but for my part, I was entranced. Geisha and Gion always use a folding fan as a prop when dancing, and Mameha, in particular, was masterful in her movements. At first, she closed the fan, and while turning her body in a circle, waved it delicately with her wrist to suggest a stream of water flowing past. Then she opened it, and it became a cup into which her companion poured sake for her to drink. As I say, the dance was lovely, and so was the music, which was played on the shamisen by a terribly thin geisha with small, watery eyes. A formal banquet generally lasts no longer than 2 hours, so by 8 o'clock we were out on the street again. I was just turning to thank Mameha and bid her good night when she said to me, "Well, I'd thought of sending you back to bed now, but you seem to be so full of energy. I'm heading to the Komoriya Tea House. Come along with me and have your first taste of an informal party. We may as well start showing you around as quickly as we can." I couldn't very well tell her I felt too tired to go, so I swallowed my real feelings and followed her up the street. The party, as she explained to me along the way, was to be given by the man who ran the National Theater in Tokyo. He knew all the important geisha in nearly every geisha district in Japan, and although he would probably be very cordial when Mameha introduced me, I shouldn't expect him to say much. My only responsibility was to be sure I always looked pretty and alert. "Just be sure you don't let anything happen to make you look bad," she warned. We entered the tea house and were shown by a maid to a room on the second floor. I hardly dared to look inside when Mameha knelt and slid open the door, but I could see 7 or 8 men seated on cushions around a table with perhaps 4 geisha. We bowed and went inside, and afterward knelt on the mats to close the door behind us, for this is the way a geisha enters a room. We greeted the other geisha first, as Mameha had told me to do, then the host at the corner of the table, and afterward the guests.
"Mameha-san," said one of the geisha, "you've come just in time to tell us the story about Kanda-san, the wig-maker."
"Oh, heavens, I can't remember it all," Mameha said, and everyone laughed. I had no idea what the joke was. Mameha led me around the table and knelt beside the host. I followed and positioned myself to one side.
"Mr. Director, please permit me to introduce my new younger sister," she said to him.
This was my cue to bow and say my name and beg the director's indulgence and so on. He was a very nervous man with bulging eyes and a kind of chicken-bone frailty. He didn't even look at me, but only flicked his cigarette in the nearly full ashtray before him and said,
"What is all this talk about Kanda-san the wig-maker? All evening the girls keep referring to it, and not a one of them will tell the story."
"Honestly, I wouldn't know," Mameha said.
"Which means," said another geisha, "that she's too embarrassed to tell it. If she won't, I suppose I'll have to." The men seemed to like this idea, but Mameha only sighed. "In the meantime, I'll give Mameha a cup of sake to calm her nerves," the director said, and washed out his own sake cup in a bowl of water on the center of the table, which was there for that very reason, before offering it to her. "Well," the other geisha began, "this fellow Kondo-san is the best wig-maker in Gion, or at least everyone says so, and for years Mameha-san went to him. She always has the best of everything, you know. Just look at her and you can tell." Mameha made a mock angry face. "She certainly has the best sneer," said one of the men. "During a performance," the geisha went on, "a wig-maker is always backstage to help with changes of costume. Often while a geisha is taking off a certain robe and putting on another one, something will slip here or there, and then suddenly, a naked breast, or a little bit of hair. You know these things happen. And anyway..." "All these years I've been working in a bank," said one of the men. "I want to be a wig maker." "There's more to it than just gawking at naked women. Anyway, Mameha-san always acts very prim and goes behind a screen to change." "Let me tell the story," Mameha interrupted. "You're going to give me a bad name. I wasn't being prim. Kondo-san was always staring at me like he couldn't wait for the next costume change, so I had a screen brought in. It's a wonder Kondo-san didn't burn a hole in it with his eyes trying to see through it the way he did."
"Why couldn't you just give him a little glimpse now and then?" the director interrupted. "How can it hurt you to be nice?"
"I've never thought of it that way," Mameha said. "You're quite right, Mr. Director. What harm can a little glimpse do? Perhaps you want to give us one right now." Everyone in the room burst out laughing at this. Just when things were starting to calm down, the director started it all over by rising to his feet and beginning to untie the sash of his robe.
"I'm only going to do this," he said to Mameha, "if you'll give me a glimpse in return."
"I never made such an offer," Mameha said.
"That isn't very generous of you."
"Generous people don't become geisha," Mameha said. "They become the patrons of geisha."
"Never mind, then," the director said, and sat back down.
I have to say I was very relieved he'd given up, because although all the others seemed to be enjoying themselves enormously, I felt embarrassed. "Where was I?" Mameha said. "Well, I had the screen brought in one day, and I thought this was enough to keep me safe from Kondo-san, but when I hurried back from the toilet at one point, I couldn't find him anywhere. I began to panic, because I needed a wig for my next entrance. But soon we found him sitting on a chest against the wall, looking very weak and sweating. I wondered if there was something wrong with his heart. He had my wig beside him, and when he saw me, he apologized and helped put it on me. Then, later that afternoon, he handed me a note he'd written." Here, Mameha's voice trailed off. At last, one of the men said,
"Well, what did it say?"
Mameha covered her eyes with her hand. She was too embarrassed to continue, and everyone in the room broke into laughter. "All right, I'll tell you what he wrote," said the geisha who'd begun the story. "It was something like this. Dearest Mameha, you are the very loveliest geisha in all of Gion, and so forth. After you have worn a wig, I always cherish it, and keep it in my workshop to put my face into it, and smell the scent of your hair many times a day. But today, when you rushed to the toilet, you gave me the greatest moment of my life. While you were inside, I hid myself at the door, and the beautiful tinkling sound, more lovely than a waterfall..." The men laughed so hard that the geisha had to wait before going on. "And the beautiful tinkling sound, more lovely than a waterfall, made me hard and stiff where I myself tinkle." "He didn't say it that way," Mameha said. "He wrote, 'The beautiful tinkling sound, more lovely than a waterfall, caused me to swell and bulge at the knowledge that your body was bare.'" "Then he told her," the other geisha said, "that he was unable to stand afterward because of the excitement, and he hoped that one day he would experience such a moment again." Of course, everyone laughed, and I pretended to laugh too, but the truth is, I was finding it difficult to believe that these men, who had paid so considerably to be there, among women wrapped in beautiful expensive robes, really wanted to hear the same sorts of stories children in the pond in Yoroido might have told. I'd imagined feeling out of my depth in a conversation about literature or kabuki or something of that sort, and of course, there were such parties in Gion. It just happened that my first was one of the more childish kind. All through Mameha's story, the man beside me had sat rubbing his splotchy face with his hands and paying little attention. Now he looked at me a long while and then asked, "What's the matter with your eyes, or have I just drunk too much?" He certainly had drunk too much, though I didn't think it would be proper to tell him. But before I could answer, his eyebrows began to twitch, and a moment later he reached up and scratched his head so much that a little cloud of snow spilled onto his shoulders. As it turned out, he was known in Gion as Mr. Snow Showers because of his terrible dandruff. He seemed to have forgotten the question he'd asked me, or maybe he never expected me to answer it, because now he asked my age. I told him I was 14.
"You're the oldest 14-year-old I've ever seen. Here, take this," he said, and handed me his empty sake cup.
"Oh, no thank you, sir," I replied, "for I'm only a novice." This was what Mameha had taught me to say, but Mr. Snowshowers didn't listen. He just held the cup in the air until I took it, and then lifted a vial of sake to pour for me. I wasn't supposed to drink sake, because an apprentice geisha, particularly one still in her novitiate, should appear childlike. But I couldn't very well disobey him. I held the sake cup out, but he scratched his head again before he poured, and I was horrified to see a few flecks settle into the cup. Mr. Snowshowers filled it with sake and said to me,
"Now drink up. Go on. First of many."
I gave him a smile and had just begun to raise the cup slowly to my lips, not knowing what else to do, when, thank heavens, Mameha rescued me. "It's your first day in Gion, Sayuri. It won't do for you to get drunk," she said, though she was speaking for the benefit of Mr. Snowshowers. "Just wet your lips and be done with it." So I obeyed her and wet my lips with the sake. And when I say that I wet my lips, I mean I pinched them shut so tightly I nearly sprained my mouth, and then tipped the sake cup until I felt the liquid against my skin. Then I put the cup down on the table hurriedly and said, "Mmm, delicious," while reaching for the handkerchief in my obi. I felt very relieved when I patted my lips with it, and I'm happy to say that Mr. Snowshowers didn't even notice, for he was busy eyeing the cup as it sat there full on the table before him. After a moment, he picked it up in two fingers and poured it right down his throat before standing and excusing himself to use the toilet. An apprentice geisha is expected to walk a man to the toilet and back, but no one expects a novice to do it. When there isn't an apprentice in the room, a man will usually walk himself to the toilet, or sometimes one of the geisha will accompany him. But Mr. Snowshower stood there gazing down at me until I realized he was waiting for me to stand. I didn't know my way around the Komoria tea house, but Mr. Snowshower certainly did. I followed him down the hall and around a corner. He stepped aside while I rolled open the door to the toilet for him. After I had closed it behind him and was waiting there in the hallway, I heard the sound of someone coming up the stairs, but I thought nothing of it. Soon Mr. Snowshowers was done, and we made our way back. When I entered the room, I saw that another geisha had joined the party along with an apprentice. They had their backs to the door, so that I didn't see their faces until I'd followed Mr. Snowshowers around the table and taken up my place once again. You can imagine how shocked I felt when I saw them, for there, on the other side of the table, was the one woman I would have given anything to avoid. It was Hatsumomo, smiling at me, and beside her sat Pumpkin. Chapter 15. Hatsumomo smiled when she was happy, like everybody else, and she was never happier than when she was about to make someone suffer. This is why she wore such a beautiful smile on her face when she said, "Oh my goodness! What a peculiar coincidence! Why, it's a novice! I really shouldn't tell the rest of this story, because I might embarrass the poor thing." I hoped Mameha would excuse herself and take me with her, but she only gave me an anxious glance. She must have felt that leaving Hatsumomo alone with these men would be like running away from a house on fire. We'd be better off to stay and control the damage.
Really, I don't think there's anything more difficult than being a novice, Hatsumomo was saying. Don't you think so, Pumpkin?
Pumpkin was a full-fledged apprentice now. She'd been a novice 6 months earlier. I glanced at her for sympathy, but she just stared at the table with her hands in her lap. Knowing her as I did, I understood that the little wrinkle at the top of her nose meant she felt upset.
"Yes, ma'am," she said. "Such a difficult time of life," Hatsumomo went on. "I can still remember how hard I found it. What is your name, little novice?"
Happily, I didn't have to respond, because Mameha spoke up.
"You're certainly right about it being a difficult time of life for you, Hatsumomo-san, though, of course, you were more awkward than most."
"I want to hear the rest of the story," said one of the men.
"And embarrass the poor novice who's just joined us," Hatsumomo said. "I'll tell it only if you promise that you won't think about this poor girl as you listen. Be sure to picture some other girl in your mind."
Hatsumomo could be ingenious in her devilishness. The men might not have pictured the story happening to me earlier, but they certainly would now.
"Let's see, where was I?" Hatsumomo began. "Oh, yes. Well, this novice I mentioned, I can't remember her name, but I ought to give her one to keep you from confusing her with this poor girl. Tell me, little novice, what is your name?"
"Sayuri, ma'am," I said, and my face felt so hot from nervousness that I wouldn't have been surprised if my makeup had simply melted and begun to drip onto my lap.
"Sayuri, how lovely. Somehow it doesn't suit you. Well, let's call this novice in the story Mayuri. Now then, one day I was walking along Shizuo Avenue with Mayuri on our way to her older sister's Okia. There was a terrible wind, the sort that rattles the windows, and poor Mayuri had so little experience with kimono, she was no heavier than a leaf, and those big sleeves can be just like sails, you know. As we were about to cross the street, she disappeared, and I heard a little sound from behind me, like, 'Ah, ah,' but very faint." Here, Hatsumomo turned to look at me. "My voice isn't high enough," she said. "Let me hear you say it. Ah, ah." Well, what could I do? I tried my best to make the noise. "No, no, much higher. Oh, never mind." Hatsumomo turned to the man beside her and said under her breath, "She isn't very bright, is she?" She shook her head for a moment and then went on. "Anyway, when I turned around, poor Mayuri was being blown backward up the street a full block behind me, with her arms and legs flailing so much she looked like a bug on its back. I nearly tore my obi laughing, but then, all of a sudden, she stumbled right off the curb into a busy intersection just as a car came zooming along. Thank heaven she was blown onto the hood. Her legs flew up, and then, if you can picture this, the wind blew right up her kimono and, well, I don't need to tell you what happened."
"You certainly do," one of the men said.
"Don't you have any imagination?" she replied. "The wind blew her kimono right up over her hips. She didn't want everyone to see her naked, so to preserve her modesty, she flipped herself around and ended up with her legs pointing in two different directions and her private parts pressed against the windshield, right in the driver's face."
Of course, the men were in hysterics by now, including the director, who tapped his sake cup on the tabletop like a machine gun and said,
"Why doesn't anything like this ever happen to me?"
"Really, Mr. Director," Hatsumomo said, "the girl was only a novice. It's not as if the driver got to see anything. I mean, can you imagine looking at the private parts of this girl across the table?"
She was talking about me, of course.
"Probably she's no different from a baby." "Girls sometimes start getting hair when they're only 11," said one of the men.
"How old are you, little Sayuri-san?" Hatsumomo asked me.
"I'm 14, ma'am," I told her, just as politely as I could.
"But I'm an old 14.
Already the men liked this, and Hatsumomo's smile hardened a bit.
14, she said. "How perfect. And of course you don't have any hair."
Oh, but I do, a good deal of it. And I reached up and patted one hand against the hair of my head. I guess this must have been a clever thing to do, although it didn't seem particularly clever to me. The men laughed harder than they'd laughed even at Hatsumomo's story. Hatsumomo laughed too, I suppose because she didn't want to seem as if the joke had been on her. As the laughter died down, Mameha and I left. We hadn't even closed the door behind us before we heard Hatsumomo excusing herself as well. She and Pumpkin followed us down the stairway.
"Why, Mameha-san," Hatsumomo said, "this has simply been too much fun. I don't know why we haven't entertained together more often."
"Yes, it has been fun," said Mameha. "I just relish the thought of what the future holds." After this, Mameha gave me a very satisfied look. She was relishing the thought of seeing Hatsumomo destroyed. That night, after bathing and removing my makeup, I was standing in the formal entrance hall answering Auntie's questions about my day, when Hatsumomo came in from the street and stood before me. Normally, she wasn't back so early, but I knew the moment I saw her face that she'd come back only for the purpose of confronting me. She wasn't even wearing her cruel smile, but had her lips pressed together in a way that looked almost unattractive. She stood before me only a moment, and then drew back her hand and slapped me across the face. The last thing I saw before her hand struck me was a glimpse of her clenched teeth like two strings of pearls. I was so stunned I can't recall what happened immediately afterward, but Auntie and Hatsumomo must have begun to argue, because the next thing I heard was Hatsumomo saying, "If this girl embarrasses me in public again, I'll be happy to slap the other side of her face."
"How did I embarrass you?" I asked her.
"You knew perfectly well what I meant when I wondered if you had hair, but you made me look like a fool."
"I owe you a favor, little Chiyo. I'll return it soon, I promise."
Hatsumomo's anger seemed to close itself up, and she walked back out of the okya where Pumpkin was waiting on the street to bow to her. I reported this to Mameha the following afternoon, but she hardly paid any attention. "What's the problem?" she said. "Hatsumomo didn't leave a mark on your face, thank heavens. You didn't expect she'd be pleased at your comment, did you?"
"I'm only concerned about what might happen the next time we run into her," I said.
"I'll tell you what will happen. We'll turn around and leave. The host may be surprised to see us walk out of a party we've just walked into, but it's better than giving Hatsumomo another chance to humiliate you. Anyway, if we run into her, it will be a blessing."
"Really, Mameha-san, I can't see how it would be a blessing.
If Hatsumomo forces us to leave a few tea houses, we'll drop in on more parties, that's all. You'll be known around Gion much faster that way." I felt reassured by Mameha's confidence. In fact, when we set out into Gion later, I expected that at the end of the night I would take off my makeup and find my skin glowing with the satisfaction of a long evening. Our first stop was a party for a young film actor who looked no older than 18, but had not a single hair on his head, not even eyelashes or eyebrows. He went on to become very famous a few years later, but only because of the manner of his death. He killed himself with a sword after murdering a young waitress in Tokyo. In any case, I thought him very strange until I noticed that he kept glancing at me. I'd lived so much of my life in the isolation of the Okya that I must admit I relished the attention. We stayed more than an hour, and Hatsumomo never showed up. It seemed to me that my fantasies of success might indeed come to pass. Next, we stopped at a party given by the Chancellor of Kyoto University. Mameha at once began talking with a man she hadn't seen in some time and left me on my own. The only space I could find at the table was beside an old man in a stained white shirt who must have been very thirsty because he was drinking continually from a glass of beer, except when he moved it away from his mouth to burp. I knelt beside him and was about to introduce myself when I heard the door slide open. I expected to see a maid delivering another round of sake, but there in the hallway knelt Hatsumomo and Pumpkin.
"Oh, good heavens," I heard Mameha say to the man she was entertaining. "Is your wristwatch accurate?"
"Very accurate," he said. "I set it every afternoon by the clock at the train station." I'm afraid Sayuri and I have no choice but to be rude and excuse ourselves. We were expected elsewhere a half hour ago. And with that, we stood and slipped out of the party the very moment after Hatsumomo and Pumpkin entered it. As we were leaving the tea house, Mameha pulled me into an empty tatami room. In the hazy darkness, I couldn't make out her features, but only the beautiful oval shape of her face with its elaborate crown of hair. If I couldn't see her, then she couldn't see me. I let my jaw sag with frustration and despair, for it seemed I would never escape Hatsumomo. "What did you say to that horrid woman earlier today?" Mameha said to me. "Nothing at all, ma'am." "Then how did she find us here?" "I didn't know we would be here myself," I said. "I couldn't possibly have told her." "My maid knows about my engagements, but I can't imagine. Well, we'll go to a party hardly anyone knows about. Naga Teru Omi was just appointed the new conductor of the Tokyo Philharmonic last week. He's come into town this afternoon to give everyone a chance to idolize him. I don't much want to go, but at least Hatsumomo won't be there." We crossed Shijo Avenue and turned down a narrow alley that smelled of sake and roasted yams. A sprinkle of laughter fell down onto us from the second-story windows brightly lit overhead. Inside the tea house, a young maid showed us to a room on the second floor, where we found the conductor sitting with his thin hair oiled back and his fingers stroking a sake cup in anger. The other men in the room were in the midst of a drinking game with two geisha, but the conductor refused to join. He talked with Mameha for a while and soon asked her to put on a dance. I don't think he cared about the dance, really. It was just a way to end the drinking games and encourage his guests to begin paying attention to him again. Just as the maid brought a shamisen to hand to one of the geisha, even before Mameha had taken up her pose, the door slid open, and I'm sure you know what I'm going to say. They were like dogs that wouldn't stop following us. It was Hatsumomo and Pumpkin once again. You should have seen the way Mameha and Hatsumomo smiled at each other. You'd almost have thought they were sharing a private joke, whereas, in fact, I'm sure Hatsumomo was relishing her victory in finding us, and as for Mameha, well, I think her smile was just a way of hiding her anger. During her dance, I could see her jaw jutting out and her nostrils flared. She didn't even come back to the table afterward, but just said to the conductor, "Thank you so much for permitting us to drop in. I'm afraid it's so late. Sayuri and I must excuse ourselves now." I can't tell you how pleased Hatsumomo looked as we closed the door behind us. I followed Mameha down the stairs. On the bottom step, she came to a halt and waited. At last, a young maid rushed into the formal entrance hall to see us out. The very same maid who'd shown us up the stairs earlier. "What a difficult life you must have as a maid," Mameha said to her. "Probably you want so many things and have so little money to spend. But tell me, what will you do with the funds you've just earned?"
"I haven't earned any funds, ma'am," she said,
but to see her swallowing so nervously, I could tell she was lying. "How much money did Hatsumomo promise you?" The maid's gaze fell at once to the floor. It wasn't until this moment that I understood what Mameha was thinking. As we learned some time afterward, Hatsumomo had indeed bribed at least one of the maids in every first-class tea house in Gion. They were asked to call Yoko, the girl who answered the telephone in our Okia, whenever Mameha and I arrived at a party. Of course, we didn't know about Yoko's involvement at the time, but Mameha was quite right in assuming that the maid in this tea house had passed a message to Hatsumomo somehow or other. The maid couldn't bring herself to look at Mameha. Even when Mameha lifted her chin, the girl still pointed her eyes downward, just as if they weighed as much as two lead balls. When we left the tea house, we could hear Hatsumomo's voice coming from the window above, for it was such a narrow alleyway that everything echoed.
"Yes, what was her name?" Hatsumomo was saying.
"Sayuko," said one of the men.
"Not Sayuko. Sayuri," said another.
"I think that's the one," Hatsumomo said. "But really, it's too embarrassing for her. I mustn't tell you. She seems like a nice girl."
"I didn't get much of an impression," one man said, "but she's very pretty."
"Such unusual eyes," said one of the geisha. "You know what I heard a man say about her eyes the other day?" Hatsumomo said. He told me they were the color of smashed worms.
Smashed worms? I've certainly never heard a color described that way before.
Well, I'll tell you what I was going to say about her, Hatsumomo went on, but you must promise not to repeat it. She has some sort of disease, and her bosoms look just like an old lady's, all droopy and wrinkled. Really, it's dreadful. I saw her in a bathhouse once.
Mameha and I had stopped to listen, but when we heard this, she gave me a little push, and we walked out of the alley together. Mameha stood for a while looking up and down the street, and then said,
I'm trying to think where we can go, but I can't think of a single place. If that woman has found us here, I suppose she can find us anywhere in Gion. You may as well go back to your Okia, Sayuri, until we come up with a new plan.
One afternoon during World War II, some years after these events I'm telling you about now, an officer took his pistol out of its holster during a party beneath the boughs of a maple tree and laid it on the straw mat to impress me. I remember being struck by its beauty. The metal had a dull gray sheen. Its curves were perfect and smooth. The oiled wood handle was richly grained. But when I thought of its real purpose, as I listened to his stories, it ceased to be beautiful at all and became something monstrous instead. This is exactly what happened to Hatsumomo in my eyes after she brought my debut to a standstill. That isn't to say I'd never considered her monstrous before, but I'd always envied her loveliness, and now I no longer did. While I ought to have been attending banquets every night, and 10 or 15 parties besides, I was forced instead to sit in the okia practicing dance and shamisen, just as though nothing in my life had changed from the year before. When Hatsumomo walked past me down the corridor in her full regalia, with her white makeup glowing above her dark robe, just like the moon in a hazy night sky, I'm sure that even a blind man would have found her beautiful, and yet I felt nothing but hatred, and heard my pulse hissing in my ears. I was summoned to Mameha's apartment several times in the next few days. Each time I hoped she was going to say she'd found a way around Hatsumomo, but she only wanted me to run errands she couldn't entrust to her maid. One afternoon I asked if she had any idea what would become of me.
I'm afraid you're an exile, Sayuri-san, for the moment, she replied.
I hope you feel more determined than ever to destroy that wicked woman, but until I've thought of a plan, it will do you no good to follow me around Gion. Of course, I was disappointed to hear it, but Mameha was quite right. Hatsumomo's ridicule would do me such harm in the eyes of men, and even in the eyes of women in Gion, that I would be better off staying home. Happily, Mameha was very resourceful and did manage to find engagements from time to time that were safe for me to attend. Hatsumomo may have closed off Gion from me, but she couldn't close off the entire world beyond it. When Mameha left Gion for an engagement, she often invited me along. I went on a day trip by train to Kobe, where Mameha cut the ribbon for a new factory. On another occasion, I joined her to accompany the former president of Nippon Telephone and Telegraph on a tour of Kyoto by limousine. This tour made quite an impression on me, for it was my first time seeing the vast city of Kyoto that lay beyond the bounds of our little Gion, not to mention my first time riding in a car. I'd never really understood how desperately some people lived during these years, until we drove along the river south of the city and saw dirty women nursing their babies under the trees along the railroad tracks, and men squatting in tattered straw sandals among the weeds. I won't pretend poor people never came to Gion, but we rarely saw anyone like these starving peasants too poor even to bathe. I could never have imagined that I, a slave terrorized by Hatsumomo's wickedness, had lived a relatively fortunate life through the Great Depression. But that day, I realized it was true. Late one morning, I returned from the school to find a note telling me to bring my makeup and brush to Mameha's apartment. When I arrived, Mr. Ichoda, who was a dresser just like Mr. Beku, was in the back room tying Mameha's obi before a full-length mirror. "Hurry up and put on your makeup," Mameha said to me. "I've laid a kimono out for you in the other room." Mameha's apartment was enormous by the standards of Gion. In addition to her main room, which measured 6 tatami mats in area, She had two other small rooms, a dressing area that doubled as a maid's room, and a room in which she slept. There, in her bedroom, was a freshly made-up futon with a complete kimono ensemble on top of it that her maid had laid out for me. I was puzzled by the futon. The sheets certainly weren't the ones Mameha had slept in the night before, for they were as smooth as fresh snow. I wondered about it while changing into the cotton dressing robe I'd brought. When I went to begin applying my makeup, Mameha told me why she had summoned me. "The Baron is back in town," she said. "He'll be coming here for lunch. I want him to meet you." I haven't had occasion to mention the Baron, but Mameha was referring to Baron Matsunaga Tsuneyoshi, her Dana. We don't have barons and counts in Japan any longer, but we did before World War II, and Baron Matsunaga was certainly among the wealthiest. His family controlled one of Japan's large banks and was very influential in finance. Originally, his older brother had inherited the title of Baron, but he had been assassinated while serving as finance minister in the cabinet of Prime Minister Inukai. Mameha's Dana, already in his 30s at that time, had not only inherited the title of Baron, but all of his brother's holdings, including a grand estate in Kyoto, not too far from Gion. His business interests kept him in Tokyo much of the time, and something else kept him there as well, for I learned many years later that he had another mistress in the geisha district of Akasaka in Tokyo. Few men are wealthy enough to afford one geisha mistress, but Baron Matsunaga Tsuneyoshi had two. Now that I knew Mameha would be spending the afternoon with her Dana, I had a much better idea why the futon in her bedroom had been made up with fresh sheets. I changed quickly into the clothing Mameha had set out for me, an underrobe of light green and a kimono in russet and yellow with a design of pine trees at the hem. By this time, one of Mameha's maids was just returning from a nearby restaurant with a big lacquer box holding the Baron's lunch. The foods inside it, on plates and bowls, were ready to be served just as in a restaurant. The largest was a flat lacquer dish with two grilled salted ayu poised on their bellies as though they were swimming down the river together. To one side stood two tiny steamed crabs of the sort that are eaten whole. A trail of streaked salt curved along the black lacquer to suggest the sand they had crossed. A few minutes later, the Baron arrived. I peeked out through a crack at the edge of the sliding door and saw him standing just outside on the landing while Mameha untied his shoes. My first impression was of an almond or some other kind of nut, because he was small and very round with a certain kind of heaviness, particularly around his eyes. Beards were very fashionable at that time, but the Baron wore a number of long, soft hairs on his face that I'm sure were supposed to resemble a beard, but looked to me more like some sort of garnish, or like the thin strips of seaweed that are sometimes sprinkled onto a bowl of rice. "Oh, Mameha, I'm exhausted," I heard him say. "How I hate these long train rides!" Finally, he stepped out of his shoes and crossed the room with brisk little steps. Earlier in the morning, Mameha's dresser had brought an overstuffed chair and a Persian rug from a storage closet across the hall and arranged them near the window. The Baron seated himself there. But as for what happened afterward, I cannot say, because Mameha's maid came over to me and bowed in apology before giving the door a gentle push to slide it the rest of the way closed. I stayed in Mameha's little dressing room for an hour or more while the maid went in and out serving the Baron's lunch. I heard the murmur of Mameha's voice occasionally, but mainly the Baron did the talking. At one point I thought he was angry with Mameha, but finally I overheard enough to understand that he was only complaining about a man he'd met the day before, who'd asked him personal questions that made him angry. At last, when the meal was over, the maid carried out cups of tea, and Mameha asked for me. I went out to kneel before the Baron, feeling very nervous, for I'd never met an aristocrat before. I bowed and begged his favor, and thought perhaps he would say something to me. But he seemed to be looking around the apartment, hardly taking notice of me at all. "Mameha," he said, "what happened to that scroll you used to have in the alcove? It was an ink painting of something or other, much better than the thing you have there now."
The scroll there now, Baron, is a poem in Matsudaira Koichi's own hand. It has hung in that alcove nearly 4 years.
4 years? Wasn't the ink painting there when I came last?